We can start early, can't we? Late evening. So this is the signal to the, we used to call it tape ministry here, I don't know what it's called now. Archive work that we're going to start. My name is David Mazenbing. This is the first of five program sessions in a series called Investing in a Better World. And I do mean financial investing. But we'll get a little further into the week before we consider the financial dimensions. Tonight is more foundational. And the session is called On White People, Liberals, and Other Christians of Good Intention. It's deliberately provocative and vague. And the thesis I put up here so you can, to keep me honest, we can keep it in front of us. What Biko wrote about white liberals in South Africa's context applies to people of power and privilege on the global level. And in case you haven't figured it out already, I think that's pretty much all Americans, at least. We're going to be looking at a book. I'm going to be reading from this book of Steve Biko's writings. I don't know if there are any copies left in the bookstore. If not, this one belongs to them, so tomorrow morning sometime there'll be one more back there. The book title is written up here, Steve Biko, I Write What I Like, Selected Writings, and it's published by the University of Chicago. I'm proud that it has stayed in continuous print for 30 years now. And there are various language editions. My favorite is the Portuguese edition in Brazil, which has a very latent understanding of black consciousness. I have to do a little bit of context because I don't. I've been talking about Biko long enough to know that he is not as well known now as he was in the wake of his death 30 years ago. So I have to provide a little bit of context, but I really don't want to repeat what I've done on other sessions here in other years because they're available on the archives, and I'll say more about that in a minute. I want to focus in particularly on this thesis, on what did he have to say to white liberals in South Africa that is directly applicable to us. And to understand that, who are the white liberals in South Africa? What was going on in South Africa? I need to do just a little bit of context here. So bear with me if you already know this, and be glad that we're all going to be on the same page by the time I get through it. So apartheid, an Afrikaans word that means apartness, officially ended with universal elections in South Africa in 1994. Some of you remember that Nelson Mandela came out of prison in 1990, and then there was a constitutional convention, and there were finally open elections in 94. Prior to that time, South Africa had a constitutionally prescribed system of white supremacy. The best jobs, the vote, the best homes, education, everything was separate. Apartness is the word apartheid. Now, the history of European colonization of Southern Africa started in about the same time that it did in the in North America, 1650 roughly, and led to the evolution of two competing white societies. It's one white society, right? But I mean, it was. But there were two white cultures. I published an article once called "The Two White Races in South Africa." The older one are the Afrikaners, misunderstood as Dutch. There's strong French Huguenot influences, some German influences. But the older white culture is Afrikaner. And in the mid-1850s, their church, and they were a deeply pious, puritanical church, apartheid was born in the white churches, in the Dutch Reformed Church in the 1850s, and only spread to the political realm 100 years later. That's not widely studied by Christians today, but it should be, because we love to point our fingers of political judgment at the Afrikaners for what happened in their elections of 1948 that brought the Nationalist Party, the Afrikaner Nationalist Party, to power on a platform promising to implement in the political sphere what they had already started and cultivated in their churches. And it's a fascinating history, which is buried somewhere in the archives years and years ago in some sessions I did on how the Dutch Reformed churches, when they started to get more than a few blacks, the whites petitioned the synod for the right to hold separate communion services. And initially the synod said, time after time, it was every 4 years they would have a synod. And time after time the synod said, get out of here. It's not even a question. You cannot have separate communion services. And then as the number of congregations that had larger and larger percentages of blacks started coming to the synod with this concern, finally, I think it was about 1856 or 64, in there somewhere, the resolution reads, due to the weakness of some of the brethren, this synod regretfully agrees that as a temporary measure, some congregations can be allowed to hold separate communion services. That was the beginning of apartheid. And it spread into the political realm 100 years later. Now, in between, the English, in between, the Afrikaners discovered gold in the northern regions. In the regions, they start in the very southern tip, and they dominate, and then the British come. So the white Afrikaners move north, encounter and conquer, thanks to guns, the indigenous populations. And then gold is discovered in the north, and the British run up there, and they fight what the British call the Anglo-Boer War, and that's probably the name we recognize. I can assure you, the Afrikaners don't call it that; they call it the War with the English. How we name our wars says a lot about which side we're on. So they fight a war in about 1900. The Afrikaners lose. They're really down on their luck. They hate the English and vice versa. But in 1948, they gain political ascendancy over the English. And the English are bitter about this. The English-speaking white liberals are bitter about the Afrikaners. And that's important background and context for understanding how Biko writes about them. Because you had, for example, at the white universities, two student organizations. You had the Afrikaans student organizations nationally among the Afrikaans-speaking universities, and then you had English-speaking university student organizations, and most of those wanted to be multiracial. And Biko, as a university student, a medical student, gets involved in the multiracial, English liberal-led student organizations, and he tries to work with the liberal whites. It's fascinating to read in the archives of this student organization some of the correspondence between him and to have talked to some of the other people who knew the history of how he tried to work in those organizations. And then, we don't have time to go into it tonight, you can find some of this in the archives in 2009 in a session called Buried Treasure, which talks about the history of African resistance in South Africa and Biko's role within it. Buried Treasure is about the man. Enduring Treasure is another session done that year about the book, and the book globally. We're going to just look at one chapter tonight. But it's fascinating to see how he talks about trying to work with the white liberals and what happened, and the kind of retreat into a black caucus that becomes a black students' organization. Now, what do you think were the differing reactions of the Afrikaners and the English liberals when the black students withdraw from the multiracial students' organization and form a black students' organization? What do you think the Afrikaners thought?
They supported it.
Absolutely. They said, this is, finally they see the light. This is apartheid. This is what we've been talking about. It's best for groups to function on their own. And the white liberals?
They're angry.
Why?
Because they feel they're being left out of the process.
And they're also in a paternalistic kind of way saying, oh, apartheid has infected the minds of the blacks. They have, it's just taken over their consciousness. They've slid back into this. Biko writes in an essay, it's chapter 5 in the book. I'm going to read out of here because this is my marked up copy and I want to keep this one clean for someone to buy tomorrow. But I want you to see what the current edition looks like. And this, I'm going to read out of this older edition. The chapter is called Black Souls and White Skins? He draws on a phrase from Frantz Fanon, the Algerian nationalist, who wrote under the same title. Can the white liberals, who have been assuring us that they're our friends, really have black souls and just happen to wear white skins? All right. So the those who have been enjoyed the privilege and benefits of the system, but able to blame someone else as responsible. That's who the white liberals are. They've been able to enjoy the benefits of the system, but they're out of power, so it's easy to blame someone else as being responsible. Sounds a lot like what I hear around me a lot of the time. I enjoy the benefits of the American system, but I'm full of critique of it, and most of the people I hang out with are right there with me. Steve had a lot to say about us. All right. Now, I've already identified, these two pieces in the archives. If you get interested in knowing more about who he was and what was the context in which he lived and died, then Buried Treasure is your archive. And if you want to know more about the book, and including someone bought it today and came up to me and said, tell me about gathering these writings. There are some very dramatic stories. They're interesting to hear, but we're not going to talk about them tonight. Because I think it's more important, more relevant for us to consider what was his critique of the white liberals who were so burned when he withdrew and caucused. It reminds me, I'm old enough to remember the women's movement in the 60s. Remember how stung men felt when women started to caucus? Whites charged reverse racism. So it's worth listening to how Steve defines racism. It's kind of an unusual definition. Now keep in mind, he's raised on Bantu education, on the black education system, and he is dead at the age of 30. So we have no idea how his thinking would have evolved over more time. He dies in police custody on September 12, 1977. But in this essay, Black Souls and White Skins, he defines racism as discrimination by a group against another for the purposes of subjugation or maintaining subjugation. In other words, one cannot be a racist unless he has the power to subjugate. And note, there's no reference to race in his definition. Because he knows what it took me a lot longer to learn, which is that race is not a biological reality. It doesn't exist. You cannot define it. And it didn't exist even as a concept until the rise of European colonialism. And then it was invented as an idea. Now, it's a very powerful reality in our society. But you cannot draw the line between where one race ends and another begins, as we think about them. And Biko knew that. So he doesn't use the concept of race in defining racism. He says it's subjugation by a group against another for the purpose of subjugation or maintaining subjugation. And if black South Africans can't do it, then they can't be racist. They can be prejudiced, but they can't be racist. What blacks are doing is merely to respond to a situation in which they find themselves the object of white racism. We're in a position in which we are because of our skin. We are collectively segregated against. What can be more logical than for us to respond as a group? When workers come together under the auspices of a trade union to strive for the betterment of their conditions, nobody expresses surprise in the Western world. It's the done thing. Nobody accuses them of separatist tendencies. Teachers fight their battles, garbage men do the same. Nobody acts as a trustee for another. Somehow, however, when blacks want to do their thing, the liberal establishment seems to detect an anomaly. This is, in fact, a counter-anomaly. The anomaly was there in the first instance when the liberals were presumptuous enough to think that it behooved them to fight the battle for the blacks. He's already, earlier in this essay, explained that one of the reasons, his critique of how whites led all these multiracial organizations, that he tried to work for change within. The global parallel, of course, would be, how many global organizations do you know that are designed to improve life for somebody that are led by people who already have an improved life? Steve is considered today the father of black consciousness in South Africa. I so regret that I did not bring with me this icon. I hope some of you have seen it. There's a, what's his name? Robert Lenz, out of New Mexico, I think, produces contemporary icons that are just wonderful. And he has one of Steve Biko, who's holding a little card that says, "Begin to look upon yourself as a human being." That's kind of Robert Lentz's interpretation of what was basic to the philosophy of Steve Biko. He's the father of black consciousness. Give dignity to blacks. He argued that, so it's worth hearing from him on black consciousness, and I'm going to go outside of chapter 5 to page 91. A couple of you have copies here. And just read his definition of black consciousness. Black consciousness is an attitude of mind and a way of life, the most positive call to emanate from the black world for a long time. Its essence is the realization by black people of the need to rally together with their brothers and sisters around the cause of their oppression, the blackness of their skin, and to operate as a group to rid themselves of the shackles that bind them to perpetual servitude. It's based on a self-examination which has ultimately led them to believe that by running away from themselves and emulating the white man, they are insulting the intelligence of whoever created them black. The philosophy of black consciousness, therefore, expresses group pride and the determination of the black to rise and attain the envisaged self. Freedom is the ability to define oneself with one's possibilities, held back not by the power of other people over one, but only by one's relationship to God into natural surroundings. On their own, therefore, black people wish to explore their surroundings and test their possibilities. In other words, to make their freedom real by whatever means they deem fit. At the heart of this kind of thinking is the realization by blacks that the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. That's one of his best known quotes. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. If one is free at heart, no human-made chains can bind one to servitude. But if one's mind is so manipulated and controlled by the oppressor as to make the oppressed believe that he is a liability to the white man, then there will be nothing the oppressed can do to scare their powerful masters. Hence, thinking along the lines of black consciousness makes the black person see themselves as being complete in themselves. It makes them less dependent and more free to express their humanity. At the end of it all, they cannot tolerate attempts by anybody to dwarf the significance of their humanity. And that last line is what proved to be true and why his influence was so crucial in the fall of apartheid. He's killed in 77. Mandela isn't released from prison until 1990. But trust me, between 77 and 1990, you just have wave after wave of black resistance, standing up and not taking it. And that comes directly from working on the consciousness of people, on what he called their inferiority complex. Steve said there are at least two problems in South Africa. There's a black inferiority complex that has come from 300 years of subjugation. I almost went away from my notes, but that's exactly what's next in my notes. I better stick to them. As long as blacks are suffering from an inferiority complex, a result of 300 years of deliberate oppression, denigration, and derision, they will be useless as co-architects of a normal society. Hence, what is necessary as a prelude to anything else that may come is a very strong grassroots buildup of black consciousness, such that blacks can learn to assert themselves and make their rightful claim. It was true, as I understood it, I mean, there are people in this room who can better articulate it than me, but as I understand it, it was true for the women's movement. Women retreated and caucused to define a sense of who they were on their own, rather than be in men-led groups who explained to them who they were. And the same thing here. But that stung the white liberals. And how do we feel today when, I remember when the Presbyterian Church in Kenya asked the missionaries to go home and stay home. Remember that? They've since invited them back on their terms. But that was an uneasy period, uneasy relationship. Presbyterians in this country didn't like it. Correspondingly, there's a white superiority complex at work. And Beagle felt that in the multiracial student organization, he tried hard to work, but he kept running up against the white superiority complex and the black inferiority complex, and he said, this is a false integration. Integration may be the goal, but it isn't necessarily an ideal means. It can't necessarily be the means to the end. He was all in favor of moving toward a colorless society, but how do you get there was the question for him. And what phase of caucusing or temporary retreat is necessary? What would be the parallel today? I mean, if we stick with the thesis here, what do you think would be the some parallels today on the global stage? I've been doing all the talking, and that's not good pedagogy.
Well, immigration.
Say more.
Basic servitude. We have people here illegally. We allow them here. Then we say we don't want them here, so we oppress them, and we use them. And for them to get out of that, they would have to do what the black people do. But it's difficult when you're not a legal citizen.
Difficult to caucus. Who defines the immigration debates?
The white people.
Right. Or American citizens. I mean, it's one community, but power isn't equally shared. And do you necessarily resolve the problem by letting a few very vulnerable people into the discussion? How do you really hear the aspirations and thoughts of undocumented workers, of people in our community that our economy requires the help from? Can you invite them into Holden Village and expect an open conversation when we're secure here and they're not? When we feel very comfortable speaking up in a group and they may not? And in whose language? Keep in mind that in South Africa at this time there were two official languages. Today there are nine. At that time the two official languages were English and Afrikaans. Any other parallels you can think of on the global stage?
What about the World Bank?
World Bank, yeah. Yeah, who has power at the World Bank? They make a lot of decisions for powerless people. But who's making those decisions? Good one. Judy.
Israel and Palestine.
Say more.
Well, the I guess I'm thinking of the liberals, the liberal Israelis who are liberal and would like to change the situation, but they benefit from the all of the powers held by Israel over the country.
They have a lot of political rights. Yeah, this if you study some of the film coming out of Israel Palestine, you can read between the lines and see this, the tension between liberal Jewish Israelis who would like to see would like to see an end to the ethnic cleansing, and Palestinians, and it's a, you know, on the one hand, they want to build bridges, but it they're not equal players when they meet on that bridge. One group has rights and privileges and better access to education, and the other group doesn't. I thought you were going to mention or ask why Holden Village flies the flag of Israel and not that of Palestine. I think it's unbelievable. I really do. And
the Palestinian flag is on Chalet 7.
Chalet 7? Well, I am in Chalet 12, where it's flying. I'm glad it's there, but I will remind you that Archbishop Desmond Tutu has singled out one country for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions as as the most peaceful way we can work to change that situation. So if there's any country in the world that is worth sanctioning and divesting from and boycotting, even at Holden Village with the flags, I think it's that one. But that's, I shouldn't get off the subject.
I don't have so much an example as a question, and maybe you get to this later, but let me ask it.
Good.
What does the liberal elite do in this situation? Now, I'm guessing that if the liberal elite is in a minority, in an oppressed majority, you could say your job should be to help empower the majority to speak in their own terms and participate in society. That might apply to the case of South Africa, that might apply to women who are essentially a majority. What do you do if the majority and the elite are the same?
If the majority and the elite are the same, like where? I love your question, but I want to be sure that I didn't stop listening when I thought I knew what you were saying.
Well, what I'm wondering is what the answer is, and so if you have an oppressed minority, for example, in the United States, African Americans or Hispanic Americans, I guess you could say, well, you can invite them to speak in their own terms, but. Does that solve the problem? In a country like South Africa, where the majority is black, you can say, well, majority rule, they will eventually then dominate the political discourse out of their majority. In a situation where the oppressed is a minority, doesn't it take the majority to do something beyond letting them speak to give rise to a solution?
Right, okay,
to protect
good.
Their rights?
Good. Well, that is exactly the situation that whites are in South Africa today. Those who have chosen to stay and want to constructively participate in the future, which is not all who have chosen to stay. I mean, there are plenty who have chosen to stay and are just complaining left and right that the country is going downhill. But there are many that are really trying to make it work and have learned, and will tell you, they've learned a whole new way of being. And I am going to come to some of that. I mean, that's really the end of this session, which I better keep my eyes on how much time we have, but thank you. I'm not, you know, how it would work in the United States, I don't know. I'm more interested in the way in which Americans are like white liberals in South Africa, vis-a-vis the world. And the world is a majority compared to us. They don't have majority power. They don't have majority influence yet. But if the world is going to live more harmoniously, are Americans going to have to learn how to be that constructive minority voice instead of leading the way to a better world?
In One of the things that I see the liberal majority or the liberal elite doing is like nation building, or where we as a Western civilization, including, we're going to include Europe, and we look at a nation that is not as developed, and we want to, and doesn't have, say, the what we consider civil rights or certain rights, we want to impose our values on that culture. And how, you know, are we taking away their ability to judge for themselves or to build themselves up, or are we, and how do we look at it with our, you know, our human rights, you know, some of our human rights, what we consider human rights, are opposed in other countries because that's their culture, that's the way
it's right.
always been.
That's right.
And how do we as this liberal world, you know, a liberal worldview, we want everybody to have democracy, we want everybody to have capitalism, we want, you know, whatever you want to define it as, but we want to impose that on the whole world.
Hard to convince the Palestinians that we want that, but
I
hear your point, and it's well taken. Thank you. I mean, those are questions. Those are the questions we're struggling with. So let me ask the question whether Steve was against integration. He asks it in this chapter. Does this mean that I'm against integration? If by integration you understand a breakthrough into white society by blacks, an assimilation and acceptance of blacks into an already established set of norms and a code of behavior set up by and maintained by whites, then yes, I'm against it. I'm against the superior, inferior, white-black stratification that makes the white a perpetual teacher and the black a perpetual pupil, and a poor one at that. I'm against the intellectual arrogance of white people that makes them believe that that white leadership is a sine qua non in this country, and that whites are divinely appointed pace-setters in progress. I'm against the fact that a settler minority should impose an entire system of values on an indigenous people. If, on the other hand, by integration you mean that there should be free participation by all members of a society, catering for the full expression of the self in a freely changing society as determined by the will of the people, then I'm with you. For one cannot escape the fact that the culture shared by the majority group in any given society must ultimately determine the broad direction taken by the joint culture of that society. This need not cramp the style of those who feel differently, but on the whole, a country in Africa in which the majority of the people are African must inevitably exhibit African values and be truly African in style. So I don't know how it would apply, you know, in your question with...
Well, this actually gives rise to my question maybe in a different way. Once the black majority now comes to power and runs the country, what is now their obligation to the white minority? How do you create a diverse society where the minority, you know, you don't want to switch from a situation where the minority oppresses to the situation where the majority oppresses. How do you create a society that can be diverse and in balance?
Good question. They're working on it. The rule of law is a concept that South Africans took with them in the transition from apartheid to the new South Africa. Many have said that it's a model constitution. It's creating, its guarantee of rights for minorities has pushed them to go a lot farther in some areas than many thought they were ready to go. I mean, it's a very conservative society in terms of its sexual politics, but to guarantee the rights of sexual minorities has really pressured some tradition and created some tensions. I'm not up to date on how they're dealing with it. I would encourage anyone who's interested to study how they're dealing with it. As far as its application to our country here, I'm less interested in that than I am in how we Americans as a minority people on the global scene, we'll learn to encourage the development of majority voice in the world that we want to share. Wes?
if throwing this into the mix, David, is distracting or not where you want to go, feel free to put it aside for now. But
spoken like a true session leader, right?
Yeah, right.
Thank you.
And because I'm interested in you having a chance to say what you want to say here. But when you were giving the brief summary of the context of South Africa, you mentioned something important and then you moved past it that I'd like to bring back into the question. You mentioned gold. And I think as we talk as human beings about consciousness, we have to recognize that we've created a legal entity where corporations are human beings, or persons anyway. And they're the ones who are making this situation in the world today. So how, you can't appeal to a quote-unquote liberal corporation to take in account the will of the majority, or to allow the majority to be self-determining, because the corporations run the world. So again, if the corporate personhood here is a distraction, feel free to put it aside. But it seems to me that's kind of, to me, that's the elephant in the living room here, and the question of these imbalances.
So I will and I won't answer it. I'll say that if you hang with me through the week, Friday I'm going to talk about a corporation that's different. As a way of making the case that there are corporations and then there are corporations. And who are corporations? We are corporations. I mean, the world out there, outside of our borders, would look at us and jeer at the thought that we disassociate ourselves from corporations. Since they all have stockholders' meetings that we just simply don't exercise our right to vote at, right?
Yes and more, but maybe we'll
get to that. Yeah, there is more to it, yeah. All right, what's the problem with white leadership? In this essay, he goes into detail. He has this wonderful phrase about, section about, it's a little bit long to read, about, well, maybe I can, let me try here. One of the problems with the black-white circles, okay, so he's critiquing the white, you're in a rigidly segregated society, and the Afrikaners live by that. The English liberals liked to invite black leaders to come round home for tea, right, which was, and Steve is addressing this essay at black people, and he's saying, come on, guys, you know how much you like those invitations. But what really happens there? First, the black-white circles are almost always the creation of white liberals. As a testimony to their claim of complete identification with the blacks, they call a few, quote-unquote, intelligent and articulate blacks to come round for tea at home, where all present ask each other the same old hackneyed question, how can we bring about change in South Africa? The more such tea parties one calls, the more of a liberal he is, and the freer he shall feel from the guilt that harnesses and binds his conscience. Hence he moves around his white circles, whites-only hotels, beaches, restaurants, and cinemas, with a lighter load, feeling that he is not like the rest of the others. Yet at the back of his mind is a constant reminder that he's quite comfortable as things stand and therefore should not bother about change. This is just a huge point that he's making, which is that there's a big gap between the consciousness of the white liberals in South Africa and their unconscious satisfaction with the status quo. And he, having gotten to know them very well and tried very hard to work with them, eventually concluded that it was hopeless, that his faith in their leadership to bring change was misplaced, and that it's the people who are desperate about the status quo who ultimately have to be built up to assume leadership, because they're the only ones really motivated to make change. Now, the consequences of that thesis on his part are huge for us. I mean, it really brings into question the whole issue of whether any of our efforts to help other people are going to make it And we're, I'm really going to be looking at that on Wednesday when I ask the question, what's wrong with charity? Which doesn't mean there isn't a role for us. It just means that it's probably not the role we think. What role we'll get to. He said the problem with white leadership is that A, it's self-serving, you know, and you kind of hear it between the lines of what I just read, that you end up feeling better about yourself. You're not like those Afrikaners who are so stubborn and creating all these problems, you know. I've had blacks in my home. He said it undermines the evolution of indigenous leadership. It's amazing, the multiracial student organizations and his efforts to work within them and realizing that they were always going to be the speakers. They were always going to be the leaders, the officers of the... They needed blacks present so that they could be proud of their multiracial character, but they didn't really want multiracial leadership. And I think, you know, you don't have to go farther than the American church to find evidence of the same dynamic. That and all the excuses we make for why others, you know, aren't really ready to assume leadership or will be glad to do it.
For the Congress.
Congress? Say more what you mean by that.
Just that we have a much more diverse American population, but it's not reflected by gender at least, but also by ethnicity in the House or the Senate.
Right. Good point.
Corporations yep. Are also diverse at the low levels, but the higher you go up, there's very
the less. Diversity. Right. Secondly, this type of integration as a means, here he's back on, is immigration the end or the means? This type of integration as a means is almost always unproductive. The participants waste a lot of time in an internal sort of mudslinging designed to prove that A is more of a liberal than B. He's really got us here. I know from reading those archives that you go to these multiracial student organization conferences and you got this white leader arguing that he's the real leader, he's the real liberal, and then there's the other white leader arguing that he's more of a liberal, and they spend all their time trying to decide who's the real leader of the party, right? And the party itself never gets around to addressing the real root problem, which is white racism. He said that white liberals lacked a sense of urgency. Their multiracial efforts were usually unproductive. They undermined the evolution of indigenous leadership, and they were self-serving. They made whites feel better about themselves rather than get the problem solved. So what to do? The liberal must understand, we're coming to it. The liberal must understand that the days of the noble savage are gone. That the blacks do not need a go-between in this struggle for their own emancipation. No true liberal, and put yourself on the global stage here as Americans. You know, hear him speaking to Americans about how to improve world problems. No true liberal should feel any resentment at the growth of black consciousness. Rather, all true liberals should realize that the place for their fight for justice is within their white society. He said to me once, the last time I saw him, that if I wanted to help, what I should do is go home and share. He first said, you've had a really unusual orientation to South Africa. He said, I don't know many whites or blacks that have been in many different corners of the country as you have. If you really want to help us, what you should do is go home and share with Americans what you've learned about South Africa, because I don't believe they'd continue to support Pretoria if they knew what you knew. And I have, as ever since then, felt, you know, my wife Maria is here. We developed a maritime ministry which worked with the down and out, with workers, working class people, from really desperately poor countries. That's who staffs the maritime industry that carries 90% of global trade. And every Christmas and Easter, you know, we'd hold services in the chapel, and I was very uncomfortable preaching to them. I don't think there's much integrity in me preaching to such people. But here, in my own country, it's a different story. And I think there's something right about saying, if I really want to help, I should work on that part of the problem to which I have more access. Since you're white, work on white racism. And I would just say that as we head into this next election season, the long and persistent theme of racism in our society is already begun to rear its ugly head, because it is a very easy and effective way for a competitor to take pot shots at the other party if that party's candidate is black. And it's up to every white person who runs into that racism to call it what it is. Right out. Because nobody wants to admit that they're racist, but we all are. And we better start with ourselves and name it every time we run into it. I got interrupted. All true liberals should realize that the place for their fight for justice is within their white society. The liberals must realize that they themselves are oppressed if they're true liberals, and therefore they must fight for their own freedom and not that of the nebulous they whom they can hardly claim, with whom they can hardly claim identification. You know, the they he's talking about are the English whites saying, I'm not like those Afrikaners, or the Americans living off of all this corporate system, saying we're not part of it, right? The liberal must apply himself with absolute dedication to the idea of educating other whites that the history of the country may have to be rewritten at some stage, and that we may live in a country where color will not serve to put a person in a box. In some other places, he says, we can participate as supportive followers rather than as the directive leaders. And we have no idea how to do that. But, you know, we practice a faith that says we can learn, or we can be taught, or we can be led. For one thing, we can start by putting ourselves in circles where we're minorities. And secondly, by shutting up and working on our listening skills. I am so sorry I wasn't here last week. How many were here last week for the Hans Bible study where they talked about acoustic, what do they call it, acoustic hospitality? Learning, I said, what? Acoustic hospitality, what's that? Learning to listen. All right, I'm going to open up for questions as we have a few minutes left. I'll just first say that that I've already referenced that we'll be talking about the debilitating consequences of helping on Wednesday. Tomorrow I will talk about microcredit in general, because I want to introduce this microcredit organization on Friday. But before we get there, microcredit needs a session on its own, because it was such a hot thing as a strategy for international development, and then it's run into so much flack recently. How do you sort all that out? And then what's wrong with charity on Wednesday? Thursday is transformational travel versus service learning project travel. And it all culminates on Friday with my favorite ecumenical organization. I'll take your questions, but we'll close with this quote after a little discussion. One, two.
I'm wondering about, you were saying that we should just let people express their own, figure out their own scheme, express their own culture. A thing that I've seen a bunch around the world, I mean, just it's clear, is that people have seen our culture or our system and said, hey, I want a piece of that. And so I think now, left to their own devices, a lot of places will try to emulate us. We've already done that damage. So what do you do to, or is there anything that we should do to try and avoid cultures sort of self-destroying themselves by trying to imitate us?
I don't think we can, I don't think we can prevent it. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. Marie and I lived in South Florida for 15 years, and we eventually left because it seemed like we were surrounded by people who either had retired and didn't want to even consider the possibility that the system needed any improvement. They just wanted to live out their years happy. Or you have in South Florida this tremendous influx of people from the Caribbean and Latin America, even Eastern Europe, and they all just want to make it in this country, and they don't want to hear that there's anything wrong with the system either. But in my experience, if you look around, the spirit is moving in wonderful ways. I ran into a couple, maybe it was a month ago, I had to do it on my day off, but I met with these two elderly Roman Catholic Filipina nuns. And they told me the story of their community in 1989 saying, thank you very much, goodbye, to the mother house from, I don't even know where, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it was in the United States or Europe or wherever. They said, we went independent. And they're connected more ecumenically than you would expect of a Roman Catholic order in the southern Philippines, the most desperately poor part, where there's been a lot of assassinations of church leaders, as a matter of fact. And they're doing amazing stuff on interfaith front with healing. I mean, these Filipino nuns, Roman Catholic nuns, 70, the one, she's got to be 75, and she had some health crisis a few years ago and figured it out. And is using Tai Chi and yoga and all, and teaching it to the community, to the impoverished community. The other sister, I wish I had my notes on this now. There are two sides to their mission. There was the contemplative side, which was the healing side, and then there was the justice side, which was taking on corporations and naming it. She said the military paves the way for the corporations to come. And they were talking. I said, are you guys safe? And she said, well, we're in coalition, and anywhere they could kill one of us, it wouldn't stop anything.
Well, you have the Filipino nuns autonomizing, you've got Microsoft moving into Bangalore, India, and I mean, that's a different kind of integration that
right.
I think has this, that to me is one of the issues that we should be looking at,
yeah.
Is how our businesses are outsourcing all the things that we're doing here. We're micro something, I'm not sure what the word
right.
is.
Right, so, but I would say the difference is, you know, at the end of the day, I get a lot of benefit from Microsoft's accumulation of capital. So I'm not saying that that means I want to defend it. I'm just saying that I better be suspicious about to what degree am I going to be effective at ever really ending what privileges me, as opposed to finding the, you know, looking around in Bangalore for who is really upset about that and maybe has a critique of it and might be desperate enough to do something about it and start taking direction from them. Now, that, you know, that I used a phrase earlier that is very, we can participate as supportive followers rather than directive leaders. And to be a supportive follower, we're going to have to find some people that we have faith in following. And you're identifying that not everybody is, but some are. And the Spirit is moving. The Spirit of Freedom moves. And our job is to find those people. I so regret that I had 3 sessions today, Elsa, and did not get to hear about the church in India. I would love to have done that. But thank God for the archives, I might.
Yeah.
you know. We can make it our passion to discover the world and to look for the world and look for signs of hope in the world, and then actually take direction on how to help rather than offer it. You had a question.
Oh, yes. This isn't a question, it's just an observation.
Good.
As I look around, Holton Village is very white. Mm-hmm. And I know it's because we come from the Love Lutheran churches, which are very white. So I'm just putting that out there.
Even though it has a fund that is actually designed to help pay for African speakers to come to the village, but it regularly struggles to find people to use it. Yeah, our churches are very white, mm-hmm. which is why I felt safe in directing myself to this subject tonight. But, you know, that's an impoverishment. It starts with recognizing it, calling it what it is, and making a priority when you go home of changing our churches. They're not all that way. It's just one, two.
This may be off the subject, but I keep thinking about how England was burning out, and we got like 10 seconds on our news on the TV, and we saw these buildings just burning like crazy, and the discussion was, is this a bunch of young white hoodlum or black young black men or white men, or why are they doing this? Does that have anything to do with what's going on right now? I mean, I remember L.A., they burned up their own houses and their own shops and their own ghetto.
Yeah, on that subject, I heard a really articulate member of parliament who's black from the district where this was happening argue that what happened recently is fundamentally different than what happened in the mid-90s when he said it was a black reaction to white bigotry of the police. That this was a totally different phenomenon, but I'm not qualified to speak about it. I think it's another phenomenon.
I was shocked at the way our press under reported that.
Yeah, well, maybe we should question our faith in our press.
Every day.
Right. You had a question or a comment.
It's a question that can you, as a newly Episcopal priest, speak to the Episcopal communion worldwide, which is seeing, I believe it's largely Southern African churches coming out against endorsing homosexual priests and marriages and splitting off to form a different even communion of churches on a global scene based largely on that kind of homophobia in some ways. I mean, it's really, if you're talking about white liberals taking a kind of supportive follower stance, it might lead to that kind of a conversation.
Well, I won't speak to it as an Episcopal priest, since I know Holton Village well enough that I was trying to stay under Lutheran cover here. And because I know, I mean, I have enough Lutheran in me to know that the issue you're speaking about is just as relevant for Lutherans as it is for Episcopalians. Which is that, you know, if my ideals about, you know, being global citizens are so easy, how come, you know, we're facing such pushback from the African church on issues of sexual inclusion or inclusion of sexual minorities? I have said many times that I think if we had given half an ear to African concerns about issues as urgent as access to water, which kills 2 million people a year and is totally preventable, or food. If we had given ear to African churches when they tried to talk with us about some of those desperate issues, there would be less difficulty having open, honest conversation about the issues of sexual politics right now. I mean, they're very important issues. And, you know, you and I are part of a congregation that has been over that issue for a long time and is glad that it is. But we're not part of Christian communions that are. And I think we start, when Americans learn to listen, can actually practice it well, we might get voice back. And if we care about the issues that we're only worked out about this issue because it's one where we think our values are right and we are in conflict with somebody that doesn't. But we've lost the dialogue already because we haven't been willing to listen to them on anything forever, really. What I think, I'm sure there are other opinions, but we are out of time, and I want to read, before we lose the 60 minutes here, this closing quote from Jean Vanier in his book, Becoming Human. It's short. "We human beings have a great facility for living illusions, for protecting our self-image with power, for justifying it all by thinking we are the favored ones of God. How difficult it is for human beings to move from the recognition of the ultimate value of their own particular culture and way of life to the acceptance of the value of other cultures and ways of living." I like that. I like that you have given me a chance to share so well tonight. Thank you. See you soon.